made by you.
Do you like Sheffield Live? Why not become a friend of Sheffield Live? Sheffield Live is a community radio station, and friends of Sheffield Live are people in the community who make a regular donation to keep Sheffield Live on the air. Join the Friends of Sheffield Live by writing to friends@sheffieldlive.org or go online to sheffieldlive.org/friends.
The swinging jazz guitar of Django Reinhardt introduces Swing Time, Sheffield Live FM's weekly selection of swing, jazz and blues. The presenters, that's me, Brian,
Keith,
Mike
and John,
offer a mixture from all periods of jazz. So if you have a liking for jazz,
tune into Swing Time every Tuesday from 1 to 3 o'clock.
Remember, it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing.
Hi, I'm Sam Hindley.
And I'm James Fagan.
Every Friday morning, it's our great pleasure to present Thank Goodness It's Folk.
Sheffield's one of the fastest growing hubs of folk music in the country. It's a thrilling city to live in. We try and bring that buzz to you every week with the best in new releases, interviews and live performances from folk musicians passing through Sheffield.
2 hours of the best folk music from the UK and beyond.
So join us on Sheffield Live every Friday from 10 a.m. for Thank Goodness It's Folk.
Sunday night at 9 p.m. it's the Night Train.
A non-stop musical journey taking in music from around the globe.
Funk, soul, rock and roll.
Latin scorchers. Scratchy 78s.
Deep gospel, Delta blues.
Heavyweight dub. Psychedelic nuggets. And a whole lot more.
The Night Train, Sundays 9 p.m. here on Sheffield Live.
Do you want to get your message heard? With low advertising rates and great sponsorship opportunities, Sheffield Live can help you reach thousands of local people. Get your campaign on Sheffield Live. To find out more about advertising on Sheffield Live, write to advertising@sheffieldlive.org or call 0114 281 4082.
Sheffield Live.
We're open for business live.
Good morning. It's just after 9 o'clock. It's Friday. It's the 12th of January, 2018. I'm Jamie Veitch. I'm your host for the next hour for Sheffield Live's business and social enterprise programme, Business Live. And we're broadcasting live from the Sheffield Live studio in the showroom workstation building in the centre of Sheffield. We're going out on FM radio and through our internet live stream. And however you're listening, the show's also available as a podcast later from the Sheffield Live website. So this is our first programme of 2018. How was your festive season? Has your business or social enterprise got off to a great start in this year? Or have you broken all of your New Year's resolutions? You can let me know later on. And what's coming up today in the programme? Well, Adam Rose, he's the operations manager for newly launched in Sheffield dockless bike sharing scheme, OFO. Now, they launched in Sheffield on Tuesday, and Adam will be on the programme to talk about OFO shortly. Before that, what else has been going on in business and in social enterprise? Well, productivity growth has risen in the UK. It's increased at the fastest rate in more than 6 years, according to stats from the Office for National Statistics. They say that economic output per hour worked, or labour productivity, grew by 0.9% in the 3 months to September 2017. And they say that that jump came thanks to stronger growth in factory output and the UK economy generating the same amount of output for fewer hours worked. Now, falling numbers of people entering the workforce and fewer hours worked were also key reasons for the gains, according to an economist at Investec, the Citibank. But the third quarter increase for last year has been the largest increase for a while, since 2011. And it is, though, still below the pre-financial crisis trend rate for the UK, which was around 2% per year. So economic growth was discussed in the autumn budget, of course, and sluggish growth in productivity has been a factor that's held down wages across the economy. So increased in productivity could be great news for the economy, for workers too. What else? Well, some Sheffield news now. Azure IT, based here in Sheffield, has received £2 million of funding from the Northern Powerhouse Investment Fund. That's the single largest investment made to date by the fund since it launched last February. And Azure works with businesses, not-for-profit enterprises, and helps them to implement business applications. They intend to strengthen their management team and to recruit additional consultants, with around 12 new jobs expected over the year ahead. And that's on top of the 57 people that Azure already employs. On a IT and data perspective, you'll have heard all about the GDPR, and you might be wondering whether you have done enough to prepare your business or your social enterprise for it, because data protection regulations are going to change significantly this year when the GDPR comes into force in May. And the Information Commissioner's Office has published plenty of guides and information on their website that you can use. They've stated last year that there's a lot of misinformation around GDPR, so it's worth taking a look at the ICO's own guides to really prepare yourself, prepare your business. They have a guide to the GDPR, a self-help checklist in terms of getting your business or your social enterprise or your charity ready for GDPR. And they also publish a new graphic in terms of steps you can take now. And of course, they're also running a helpline for small organisations, so you can phone them up and get details of what you need to do. A couple of events coming up. The Business and IP Centre is running a multitude of events, most of which are free and help you to access details about protecting copyright, trademarks and so on. Take a look on Eventbrite, look up Business and IP Centre in Sheffield. And Women Leading Social Change will be hosted by Sheffield Hallam University and the Sheffield Social Enterprise Network in March on International Women's Day. That's going to be part of SheFest, and the event full details are available both on the Sheffield Social Enterprise Network website, ssen.org.uk, and take a look on Eventbrite and you'll be able to look up Women Leading Social Change for details of that. And the event is going to hear from three successful social entrepreneurs talking about why and how the social enterprise sector is changing the way business works, as well as challenges and successes that those social entrepreneurs have heard on the way. So looks worth going along to. Find out more on Eventbrite. Big Lottery, which funds many community organisations and community businesses, social enterprises too, has been awarded £330 million of extra funding. That's come from dormant bank accounts, and it means that Big Lottery has an extra £330 million to distribute to good causes. They were trapped in long dormant bank accounts. They'll be freed up by the government's Office for Sport and Civil Society. And they say that good causes may include homelessness and things that will increase financial inclusion. And the Big Lottery Fund will be distributing these new funds through their existing channels. So take a look at Big Lottery Fund website for details of the many and varied revenue and capital funding streams that they have. So I think it's time that we took a break for a track of music, and we're going to play something something by Jamiroquai. This is Emergency on Planet Earth.
Education. Whoa, ho, ho. And the streets are never clear.
This is Business Live, Sheffield Live's weekly business and social enterprise programme with me, Jamie Veitch. Now, I'm really delighted to welcome our studio guest for today into the studio, Adam Rose, who is the operations manager for Ofo. Adam, hello, good morning.
Hi, Jamie. Thanks for having me today.
Thanks so much for coming in. So, no Ofo, problem. Dockless bike sharing system launched in Sheffield this week. Loads of yellow bikes all over the city. I'm really excited about this. But tell me more. What does dockless bike sharing mean in practice? What's the concept?
Okay, so the concept there is, and the key word, if you like, is dockless. So, yes. We've seen bike sharing before. We're not massively used to it here in the UK. So, we have the Santander cycles or the Boris bikes. If you like, they've kind of set the largest sort of public mindset for what bike sharing is, and that works quite well. However, there are limitations. It works inside a very small area. It has to be a very condensed area. It's quite expensive to set up those docking stations for that company. There's a lot of infrastructure, a lot of planning that goes into putting those docking stations in. Predominantly, the main holdback for those guys is that as a user, you can use the website or the app to check if there are bikes available in a dock, but it's rush hour. So at rush hour, you get to the train station, Waterloo being a prime example. You can't leave the bike anywhere. You have to dock the bike in a docking station. If the dock's full, you have to move on to the next
trouble,
one. Exactly.
Yeah.
And then the next one and then the next one until you find a space to put the bike into. Then you have to run all the way back to the station and hope that you can still make your train.
Yes.
And this is where dockless comes in. We don't need docking stations. So we have hubs. We have preferred parking locations, but there's no locking to any physical infrastructure. You can literally leave the bike on the pavement. You could leave it in a parking place. You could leave it up against existing bike parking. You could keep it outside your house if you wanted to. You know, there's no limit to where you can put them as long as you're not causing an obstruction.
Okay, great. So key word there is dockless. You can leave it wherever you like as long as you're not causing an obstruction. That provides convenience, as you say. So you cycle somewhere to a railway station as a case in point. You don't have that problem of trying to put the bike into a dock and the dock being full. Okay, so convenience from dockless. How does that work in practice then? In terms of I want to find a bike. You've mentioned there are hubs. Mm-hmm. Where are they? And how do I find a bike, whether it's at a hub or elsewhere?
Okay, so the hubs are good. The main reason for the hubs actually is to help us as a ground team sort of consolidate the bikes. So we want them to be everywhere. The idea is that you ride everywhere, but also it's good to know as a user that there are going to be bikes in certain locations. So for example, with the hospitals, with Meadow Hall, with the universities, with the halls of residence, with the train stations, sort of high footfall shopping areas or certain entrances to certain buildings and businesses, we'll always make sure there's a presence of bikes there. We also incentivize those hubs by they're electronically marked on the app, so you can see where they are. And if you leave a bike in a hub, so you end your ride in one of those hubs, you actually receive a coupon for a free ride the next time round. So we're giving away these free rides in order to kind of incentivize people to kind of keep the areas around these buildings neat and tidy so that our bikes aren't sort of in people's ways.
Okay, so it's a sort of nudging, incentivizing behavior to leave a bike in a place where you want people to.
Exactly, but yeah. it's by no means what we rely on for the scheme. You know, we rely on the fact that you literally can ride this to your front door, you can literally ride it to your office building. And so for that, identifying bikes, there's two ways of doing it. The first is that they're bright yellow, which is kind of handy because they are, as you've seen around town, they're very, very visible. You can see them at quite a distance. And secondly, on the app. So the app is really the key. The app is the product here. A lot of work goes into that app, and the app shows up. All the bikes have GPS trackers in the locks, and the app shows up where all of those bikes are. So as a user, you can just open up the app, see where your closest bike is going to be. You can click on that bike. It'll then show you a route on a map, how to get there, how long it's going to take you to get there, and how far away it is. You can then walk to that bike, and then when you get to that bike, you use the app to unlock the lock and ride the bike away.
Yes, and that is utilising a QR code.
That's it. Yeah. So there's two QR codes on the bike, one on the mudguard and one on the actual locking system on the back of the bike itself. And when I talk about a lock, just to be clear, it's a lock that locks it to itself. So it's called a nurse's lock. It slides through the spokes so that the bike can't be ridden. It doesn't lock to anything.
Indeed. So this is a sort of ring round the frame in the back wheel.
That's it.
Okay. So loads of questions.
Please.
And first of all, the idea of the bikes that lock to themselves. The first question that that leads to is there a risk of bikes being stolen, picked up and put in the back of a van and taken elsewhere?
It is possible. Mm-hmm. Instances of this, I won't say they haven't occurred. However, they have occurred in extremely low numbers. And we as an operations team in the UK, have been quite surprised, actually, at just how few bikes get sort of lifted, if you like, get pinched. If you think about it, really, there's an awful lot of bikes. There are a certain type of bike. I mean, there's a lot of reasons not to steal them. One, they're everywhere. You don't really need to steal them. They're very cheap. So, again, you don't really need to steal them to be able to use them because it's just 50 pence for half an hour. The parts on the bike are relatively standard parts, but all of the bolts on the bike are very awkward security bolts. And I say that from a mechanic's point of view. It's a nightmare to find any kind of tooling or to get tooling made in order to work on the bikes. So stripping the bikes down is very difficult.
Okay.
And like I said, the parts on the bike, nothing's of particular value in itself. The bike of itself, I suppose, is fairly valuable, but they're so distinctive. We have seen, you know, people sort of trying to paint them and do other things with them, but they're so distinctive. It's very, very easy for us as a ground team, or in fact as the public, to spot them. They report them. We very quickly get them back, and we find it's not really that much of an issue at all. Is that there's one or two, sometimes even fairly funny instances of people trying to privatise bikes with a bit of paint, but essentially it doesn't affect us.
Okay, great. That's helpful to know. Thank you. So, on the point of view of the user experience, just returning to that. Mm-hmm. I've got the app on my phone, I turn up, I scan the QR code, I unlock the bike and I get on and go. Now, how does the charging work? At the moment, people can ride the bike for free in your initial mm-hmm. period, but yep. What's the model from a consumer point of view? How much does it cost people? Mm-hmm. When will that kick in?
Okay, so you scan the QR code on the back of the bike to register. So you scan it. You can either download the app by finding the app yourself on Google Play or on App Store. If not, then scan the QR code and it will automatically take you to the app download. Download the app. Four bits of information need to go in. So it's a name, a telephone number, an email address, and then a debit or credit card detail. And that debit or credit card detail ensures that the service is only available to 16-year-olds and above. From there, you scan the QR code again, and the bike automatically locks via Bluetooth. If you don't have Bluetooth or you don't want to give permission for Bluetooth to be used by the app, then it'll send you a four-digit code, and you'll notice on the back of the bikes on the lock there's a keypad, and you can blip in that four-digit code, and it'll unlock manually if you like.
Okay.
But generally, it unlocks automatically via Bluetooth. As soon as that lock pings open, that's the beginning of your charging period. So yes, right now you're right to say, and thank you for bringing that up, we are free. And I forget to talk about that enough, in fact, that we are free for 2 weeks. It won't cost you anything. You still have to sign up to the scheme. You still have to put a credit or debit card detail in, but no charges will be made whatsoever. Doesn't matter how long you ride the bike for. In a day, you will not be charged. Doesn't matter how many times you ride the bike, you will not be charged for this 2 week period. When that 2 week period is over, however, then you will be charged 50 pence per 30 minutes. So for a 29-minute bike ride, or say a 30-minute bike ride, you'll be charged 50 pence. For a 31-minute bike ride, up to an hour, you'll be charged £1,
okay,
and so on and so forth. If you go out for an epic 12-hour bike ride on an OFO, good on you, but it's capped at £5. You'll only ever be charged £5 as a maximum. If you jump on and off bikes, so you start a ride, end a ride, and then later on in the day, start another ride, end a ride, then you can accumulate a charge of greater than £5. But on a single ride, you'll never be charged more than £5. The period is ended when you slide that little ring lock, that nurse's lock, closed on the back of the bike, and it then automatically ends your ride. It updates your app and tells you how much you've been charged, and debits you there and then. And gives you some stats as well, how far you went, how many calories you burnt, and it gives you the option to share that data on social media.
Great. Okay, so that's really helpful in terms of how charging works, and I think that's very comprehensive in terms of the charging period as well, and the cap per day. Now, what if I get on a bike and cycle out from Sheffield out to Haddisage, for example, and decide that I'm going to leave the bike there?
Mm-hmm.
How would that work?
We know it's going to happen. I already see the existing scheme in Sheffield by Cycle, the council uni scheme.
Yeah.
I'm a cyclist, and when I'm out in the peaks on my road bike, on occasion I do see some have-a-go heroes out there on one of those bikes in the hills, and I think fair play to them, but as long as they ride them back is the big issue. So we know that people, particularly students, I'd go so far as even sometimes probably particularly foreign students who want to see a bit of the Peak District, will jump on the OFOs, they will ride right out to the Peak District. It's a bit of a hill, getting up there to Owler Bar and then dropping over the other side. They'll have a coffee and then they'll think, you know what, there's a train station here. I'll get the train back, thank you very much. And they'll leave the bike. So we have a van as part of our redistribution crew that circulates the city every day, and we bring bikes in that have gone outside of the geofence. Now the geofence is clearly marked in the app. You can see where it is, and it's been quite interesting to see actually just how many bikes we have littered bang on the line of the geofence. So people seem to already, and it is for us, they already understand what the geofence is. So people are riding up to the geofence, literally stopping dead, locking the bike up, and then walking the rest of the way, unless it just so happens that a lot of people live bang on that line. And that's absolutely fine, nothing wrong with that. There's also nothing wrong with leaving the geofenced area as long as you come back.
Yeah.
So if you want to go to Hathersage, that's fine in a way. It's not really what the scheme was kind of designed for, but it's possible, it's capable of doing it. If you bring the bike back in again, and lock the bike up within the geofenced area, that's what we're most concerned about. If you do end your ride, which actually is what we'd recommend you do, so if you go out of the geo zone and you are going to get off the bike, we would like to end the ride to lock it up. When you do that, you'll get an in-app notification and you'll get a text message just stating that you've left the geo zone and locked the bike outside of the geo zone, and that you'll need to return it within 12 hours. So you actually have 12 hours to return it back before we're really that bothered about it.
Right.
So if another user comes along and takes it, then that's great. If you yourself ride it back and lock it back within the geo zone within 12 hours, that's fine as well. If you don't, we send the heavies around. No, I'm only joking. there's a point system in the app. So every user gets 100 points. And every time you use the system, you gain a point. Every time you report somebody else's abuse, you gain points. Every time you report an issue with a bike, you gain points. You lose points when you were the last user and the bike was parked irresponsibly, or if you, in this case, for example, as you park the bike outside of the geo zone and didn't bring it back in again, you'll lose 20 points for that.
And that point system is something that you've tested and built and found that has worked elsewhere.
It's worked. It's certainly an incentive. We want people to get behind the points. Yeah. We want people to earn points. Currently now, we don't monetize it. However, in the particular instance of bikes going outside of the geo zone, we are about to introduce a charge. So if bikes go too far out, you know, we are sending a man and a van essentially to go out and pick that bike up again. There's a cost associated to that. We've been absorbing that cost up until now, but in the future that's something that we will be charging for. So, you know, we have the credit card details, that'll be in the terms and conditions. And it's something that we're going to need to do in order to keep the bike sort of reined into the operational area.
Sure. Okay. Well, that was a really comprehensive answer. Thanks for that. And it's an obvious question that people might choose to get on a bike, particularly in a city like Sheffield, and explore the Peak District.
Of course.
And so on. But you've brought up the concept of the geozone there, which is a generous area of the city centre and beyond. And you go out the Don Valley and up to Meadowhall and so on. Mm-hmm. So you've described how that's clearly marked within the app, but just sort of describe the area that you cover, if you can, in simple summary terms.
Yeah, no problem at all. So we actually have two geozones. So right now we're in phase one. So we're on geozone one, if you like, if we're going to go into detail with it. So that obviously covers the inner ring road of the city centre. It goes out as far to the east as to cover the universities and the hospitals, and right out to some of the halls out at, say, Crosspool, around that area. We then swing up clockwise. We go up round to the north, and we're going up as high as...
Hospital.
Yeah, we've got Hillsborough Stadium. Oh. So we have a hub location up there. Then we hit the Northern General. Yeah. And there's kind of a straight line across the north there. So Hillsborough Stadium, Northern General, and Meadowhall. So that's kind of as north as we go. Yeah. But that's quite a broad area across the top there. And the geos, and you'll notice on the app, is a bit of an odd shape in the way that it kind of loops those areas in.
Yes.
We go out as far as sort of Darnell Station and a little bit beyond on the east side. And then coming back round, we go as low as Mearsbrook to sort of the Tesco Express sort of and Bernardo's charity shop crossroads junction down there. Mm-hmm. Now this is just a phase one. Whilst we're introducing the first load of bikes, so when we get over a certain number of bikes, and we have enough bikes to be offering a comprehensive service for that area, we then move to phase two. Phase two pushes out at the north, actually only pushes out a little bit more because we're already going quite north. So we push out a little bit into Magna. into the science park there, into the business park there, a little bit more residential around Hillsborough. And then to the south, we'll be going down as far as Doran Totley, mainly taking the train station down there.
Right, yeah.
And there is actually, in phase one, it's not turned on right now, but it will be later on. We will have a satellite geofence around Doran Totley station. And what that's going to do during phase one is enable people to pick up a bike from the station and ride it into town, or vice versa.
Yeah.
So although that Doran Totley train station car park is a long way out of town, you can't leave a bike anywhere in between, but you can leave a bike at the station and vice versa.
Right, yes, got it.
It's basically that the train service there, it's great that there is one, but it sometimes does only run every few hours. I think today is a great example for that. I don't think there's a train running from now until this evening for some reason. So when people are relying on that service because they're parking in the area or because they live in the area and they're used to using that service to get into town, if the trains aren't working, if they can't sort of, if there's a connection on there, you can jump on an OFO, and it's a fairly flat route all the way into town.
It is pretty flat from Doran Totley station to town, yeah, indeed. So that makes a lot of sense as a satellite there. That's great. Now, you talked about phases there, phase one and phase two. Is there a timescale that you're publicly committing to in terms of when phase two is coming?
I'm not going to give dates because we find that, you know, there's a lot of, it's a very sort of multifaceted operation in order to deliver bikes, and there's always the odd hiccup and the odd delay and the odd time delay there, so we have an idea of when we want to be doing it. Phase two will basically be kicking in by spring. So by the end of March, if not before. So I can comfortably say end of March, but I would like to think it would be well before that. That is when we'll publicise a phase two, and you'll notice on the app that the geozone really pushes right out to take in the outlying residential areas as well.
Okay, grand, super. Now, I've got some specific questions about Sheffield.
Okay, please, yeah.
You've mentioned hills.
Yeah.
I love cycling to town.
Yep.
It's great. It's slightly harder to cycle home, although I really enjoy it personally. But not everyone copes wonderfully well with hills, particularly for new cyclists or people who haven't cycled that much. So your bikes have been designed in Sheffield with gears. Tell us a little bit more about the design and how you've made the design specific to the needs of Sheffielders.
Okay, so we launched some of our other cities. So in the UK, we're live in Cambridge, Oxford, Norwich. Norwich is not the flattest place, but it's not super hilly. London, so we're in boroughs of Hackney, yeah. City of London and Islington, all very flat. So single speed worked well in all those areas, but we were never going to try and launch Sheffield with a single speed bike. So the three-geared bike luckily was developed and came along, and we made sure that was going to be in place before we ever tried to launch Sheffield. So it's a three-geared bike. There's a 36-tooth front sprocket, and there's a 16-tooth rear sprocket. However, those ratios don't convert to standard ratios because there's an internal hub gear on the bike.
Yeah.
So the actual gear inches get lost within that internal hub gear. But we have a three-speed bike there. Now, the gap between each gear shift is equal. So we don't have like a big ramp up first gear, if you like, for the hills, which, you know, I admit would be ideal, that they're evenly spaced. So we have a gear that's great for slightly downhill, or wind behind you on the flat, if you like. Second gear is good for sort of tootling along the flat or pulling away. And then first gear is good for sort of, you know, loaded pulling away, or for the hills, obviously. Now, as with any bike, you can find a hill to top out the gears. You know, there's no bike that can just creep up any hill without any effort. It's always going to take an increased amount of effort. And that's certainly the case with these bikes. So we're not saying that they're hill climbers. We're just saying that it is possible to get up hills, depending on the sort of level of effort that you want to put in.
Okay, grand. So you have the facility to use the gears on the bike. The bikes have gears. You've implemented bikes in other cities that are single speed, but Sheffield certainly needs geared bikes. As you say, however fit we are, we might find that we would love an extra gear.
Yep, yeah.
We might find we'd like an extra gear at the top end as well for going fast. But three gears gives you some degree of flexibility. Now, those are internal gears. It's an internal hub gear. So how weatherproof are the bikes in terms of standing up to the wear and tear that they can expect by being used outside, obviously, but also left outside all the time? How maintenance proof is the design of the bikes?
Okay. So with the gears in particular, I'll start there. They're internal hub gear. A big part of the reason for that is that there's no derailleur hanging outside of the bike that can be bent or knocked. And derailleurs are great, but they are quite fragile if there's kind of, you know, knocked around or crashed, etc. So internal hub gears keep everything inside. They also run with an oil bath inside them. So you don't have to lube them up. They just keep on working. So our gears are supplied by Shimano. It's a Shimano Nexus 3-speed system.
Yeah.
So that's the shifter and the hub gear itself. It's extremely reliable. I have to say that for all the cities that we've launched this bike in, we've had no problems. It's been absolutely perfect. So we're really happy with that. As far as the rest of the bike, I can let you know, is designed to sit outside day and night, 365 days a year, in all weathers, including the weather that Sheffield can throw, for 2 years. As long as it's ridden normally, and as long as it's not abused or you know, dropped or kicked about, the kickstand's always used, for example, the bike's designed to manage that period of time for 2 years without needing maintenance. Now, there often is maintenance required because the odd thing happens. You know, a stiff wind might blow a bike over and bend a mudguard, for example, and we need to bend that mudguard back. But generally, the tyres are solid. They're not inflatable tyres, so they feel like inflatable tyres, pumped up to about sort of 90 psi. So a touch on the firm side, but they're grippy. They're made for a mixed surface, so it's not just for tarmac. If you want to take them on a cycle trail, that they deal with that as well. So we don't have any problems with those. The wheels are of a high spoke count, so they're pretty stiff. They're 36 spoke wheels back and front. The frames are aluminium. The fork is aluminium, and they're very robust as well. You can see that in the frame design. We do have a hydraulic dropper seat post on there, which, again, we get very, very few problems with those. It's a fairly complicated bit of kit, that, but it's designed to be left outside all weathers, all temperatures, and it works fine.
Right. So, I mean, helpful there to know that. And I was going to ask you about punctures and the tyres.
Yep.
So you've answered that question already. With the seat post, you mentioned hydraulic seat post, so it raises and lowers. What's a typical range in terms of heights that the bikes will work for? I mean, a 6-footer, yeah. 5-footer?
Yeah, no, okay, so there's 100 millimetres of drop, so 10 centimetres of adjustment on that seat post, which is a lot and suits most people. Of course, we're never going to make the bike fit perfectly someone who's 6'4", or above. In fact, the bike is still rideable by all means, but you'll be riding with a very slightly bent leg.
Yeah.
So height-wise, at the bottom end, gosh, I'd say we're going from sort of 5'4", 5'5".
Yeah.
We're covering off quite comfortably. Obviously, you could still ride the bike if you were shorter, but that's probably the comfortable range.
Yeah.
Up to about 6 foot, yeah. It's comfortable. I ride the bike and I'm 6'4 myself, and quite leggy at that. So I can ride the bike, no problem. And I do ride the bike quite a lot. If I was doing a long journey though, if I was doing sort of above 10 kilometers on a commute, then it would be okay. I just take it easy, but I would find it slightly more arduous, particularly on the hills with having a slightly bent leg.
Yeah. Sure thing. Now, I want to ask you about lighting, if I may, because coming into the studio this morning, it's really, really notable that many of us on a bicycle are using lights at 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning, but some people don't. Many car drivers are using lights, but some car drivers don't. Again, in the evenings, around twilight, visibility absolutely crucial for riders. I know the answer to this, but I'm going to let you give the answer to the question. What about lighting for your bicycles?
Okay, it's a nice thing with the lights on the bike, because you get on it and you don't have to think about it at all. You just ride away and the lights will just come on. So the front light is a dynamo. It's a Panasonic dynamo front hub with a roller brake attached to it, and that powers a dynamo Cree LED light that's attached underneath the basket. So it's underneath the basket, so it doesn't get damaged, doesn't get knocked. It casts a bit of a beam, actually, so you can just about see where you're going, as well as being seen and being safe. It'll put enough of a beam out to kind of, you know, see potholes and other obstructions. That's always on. That comes on automatically. That's on day or night, and it's been designed for that. The rear light is not connected to anything. It's a solar powered rear light, which people sometimes laugh at, solar powered lights, but there is a battery in there, so it charges up when it receives UV. It charges up throughout the day, stores the energy in the battery, and then it's on a motion sensor and a light sensor. So sometimes people think the rear light isn't working, but it's purely because you're either not going anywhere, the bike is stationary, or that it's not dark enough. So when it's dark enough and when you're moving, the light automatically comes on, and they're pretty reliable. You know, there's a cage built around those lights as well on a previous generation. There was nothing wrong with the light, but we were finding it was a little bit exposed on the back of the mudguard and people were accidentally knocking it and breaking the light. So there's a cage around the light now, which means they're far more robust, and they work really well. But as peace of mind, I mean, do check by all means, as a cyclist, when you get on, that the lights are functioning, because of course there are those instances where a light may stop working. But generally, you can jump on the bike and just ride it, no matter what the light condition, and the lights will just come on automatically if they need to come on. There is a report function in the app, which is quite visible when you end a ride, to report any issues that you've had. And we do sort of welcome people using that. We want the feedback. We use that. Excuse me. We use that to task our marshals. Sorry, and to send our marshals out to pick up problems.
Yeah.
Okay. So if a light's not working, please go, and you know, when you finish that ride, or if you're going to put that bike back and grab another bike, just mark in the app that there's a problem with the light. We'll come out as a ground team, collect that bike straight away, and get the light fixed.
Okay, great. But as a OFO user, I can expect that the lights will, the inbuilt lights in the bikes will be working, and that I can bring my own supplementary lights, but I can use the bicycle to cycle in twilight or in the dark without needing to bring my own supplementary lighting.
Yep, indeed. There's no barrier, or you know, there's nothing in terms of conditions about riding the bike at night. In the dead of night, it's absolutely fine. So that the bike is meant for all weathers, all light conditions, all times of day. It's meant for all surfaces, as far as a city and or touring bike is designed for. That's the limitation there. So please don't take it down the beast in the B district. It wouldn't be very comfortable for you. It probably won't end well for you or the bike. But the bike isn't built to take that kind of abuse. It is built to, say, take on a light trail. Some of the cycle paths that we have around the city, on the outsides of the city, are mixed surface cycle paths. So those kind of light gravel paths, not a problem at all. They're fine for those. But anything too rough is gonna cause some damage.
So as you say, the beast in the Peak District, or one of the MTB routes that you might need a mountain bike to tackle, not suitable, but mixed surface, great. So you could the type of thing where I suppose the disused railway tunnels, exactly, say between Bakewell and Buxton,
and again, without trying to actively encourage people to load the bike in a car and take it somewhere, which is not what you should be doing, really, but you know, it happens. But yeah, if you were to take a big ride out, or to hire a bike and take it out to the Tissington Trail or the High Peak Trail or the Monsall Trail, those kind of trails, family trails where there's a mixed surface, there's kind of a hard pack gravel down as well as mixes of tarmac, it's fine for, you know, the bike can handle those kind of surfaces for sure. Yeah.
Okay, grand. Well, let's return to the city, and I think we'll take a break for a track of music in a moment or two, but I've got lots more to ask you,
Adam.
Please,
it's fine.
So let's return to the city, and on the theme of sort of bike trails and cycling, obviously you like to encourage people to use the bikes to commute, so make city centre journeys. And you've talked about other cities where you've been operating, and in London, notably, the cycle superhighways have really, really taken off. I lived in London in the 90s and commuted by bike from Camberwell and South London through to Islington every day, 7 miles each way, and it was sort of somewhat terrifying quite often. To do that journey now would be great fun on the cycle superhighways that have been built, in terms of quite a lot of investment in cycling infrastructure in the city of London. Now, Sheffield doesn't have that full network of cycle lanes that we cyclists might wish for, yearn for, and love. Should people be trained in terms of how to cycle in the city? Is cycling safe? Do you have a view on that, either as a person, not representing the company that you work for, or does OFO have a view on that?
I think my views are in line with OFO, which is why part of the reason why I'm here. I'm a, you know, I used to own I used to own the Bike Tree in Sheffield. I've been in cycle retail now for about 20 years. So retail and retail operations has always been my background. The reason for that is because it's my passion. So I'm a cyclist through and through. I race, I ride MTB, I ride road, I ride trials, I commute, I cycle pack, bike pack, tour the lot. So that's me through and through. And my wife will tell you that I get unsettled when I haven't had a ride in a few days. And that time is upon us, having been busy at work recently. I have strong views on cycle infrastructure and what I'd like to see. Working with the council closely in my role as an operations manager for OFO, though, I've been privy to see those discussions that happen at a slightly higher level at trying to implement those bits of infrastructure. And it is difficult and it's not straightforward and it is a big ship to turn around. Mentality. Money is obviously one thing. Space to plan is another, but mentality, I would say, is the biggest. And what I like about those London superhighways and that I was surprised about was not the money that was thrown in it, was not the size of the project, it was the mentality, because they sacrificed a lane for cars.
Yep.
And that was key. When I first saw those superhighways in London, I thought, wow, okay, this is displaying the fact that they're clicking, that actually the city cannot take more cars. You know, they're doing everything they can to get cars out of the city with the congestion charges, etc. So, you know, it's at the rate of growth that any city experiences, Sheffield included, we have to plan for the future, not just for the short or midterm, but for the long term. And as the population grows, the city can't just suddenly expand. It can't just suddenly put more roadways in. We have to do something else. So public transport has to improve. And cycling has to be provided for. So I won't say that cycling is not safe. I think actually the biggest problem in Sheffield for cycling is probably the road surface rather than the traffic.
Oh, yes.
Indeed. So the surface is very interesting. But the traffic is a problem anywhere. I commute myself all the way in from sort of Bradway every day. And there is a cycle lane. I don't want to put down the people who've put that cycle lane in place, because at least there is some provision there, but it is made up of bits of alleyway, bits of road, bits of path, you know, kind of it's very bitty and it's quite slow to ride down, but it is traffic free for the most part. So there's definitely some work that needs to be done there in Sheffield. The people that are in charge of that in Sheffield do have the right mentality. They do want to see more bikes. They do want to give more space to it, but obviously we're up against the car user. And as you know, more than half the journeys in Sheffield are done by car. This is a target that the council are working hard to try and change. That's a big part of us being here in town. OFO, we're here to try and help achieve that goal of having a high percentage of users coming by bike. But the car, unfortunately, is winning right now, and it's the car that receives a good chunk of funding for, you know, expanding lanes, for putting more road infrastructure in. So the mentality is there from the cycle side, but it's probably not there enough, I would say, and more needs to be done. From a funding point of view, but mainly let's start giving up on roadways and trying to improve them so much and increase the size of them and actually start looking at alternatives instead, and cycling being one of those.
Okay, great. Well, that's a comprehensive answer again. Thanks very much for that, Adam. And I'm really glad that you brought in your own personal career history and your obvious cyclist through and through, from a sort of commuting point of view through to leisure and what you love doing all the time, road, MTB and so on. And the Bike Tree was a shop that personally I had bought tyres from for my bikes. So you've talked there about mentality in a big way, and the mentality, say, in London of giving up a car lane to create cycle superhighways, and infrastructure investment as well, and how the car benefits from all the investment that local government and central government pours into roads. You've talked about road surfaces there, and sometimes a poor surface on bike lanes and ordinary roads too. And on the point of view of investment and an organisation like OFO coming to Sheffield, can you talk about whether you are working with the council? Do they help you bring a scheme to Sheffield? Do they support you? Is there a financial incentive for you to do that from the council? How does money, how does the revenue work for OFO? Is it anything you're publicly able to describe?
Yeah, no, of course. So I'm very happy and keen to push the point that this costs the council nothing.
Right.
So although we're providing a public service, we are a private company. doing so. All we seek from the council is support. And if you like, permission. We kind of consider the council being the biggest sort of land-owning, estate-owning stakeholder in any city or in any town. It's them that we'll always approach first, followed by universities, followed by large businesses or hospitals, etc., who also own a lot of land, just to make sure that everyone's okay with us operating on the land. Obviously, once we launch the scheme, we can't actually control where the bikes go. We can try, but it's very hard to actually sort of stop people being able to take the bikes onto certain bits of land. So the council's key. We don't ask much for them, like I say, apart from them sort of helping us to engage with other stakeholders to sort of seek permission to work with other people. But, you know, they're not paying us money to sort of bring the bikes in. So we're privately funded from Chinese sort of big blue chip companies, basically. So it's quite public, our sort of funding. So just to go over a couple of figures from our funding side of things. So we had a successful round of funding middle of last year that raised $700 million, which made us one of the best funded bike sharing schemes in the world. And we then received a further $1 billion of investment from a single investor, which is the biggest retail giant in China. And that came right at the back end of last year. And then there's the possibility of another similar investment coming through in the near future. So we are working through our investors' money, if you like, in order to launch.
Yeah.
In order to implement these schemes in cities. However, there's 50 pence charge per day per ride on a bike, accumulating over the bikes over a daily period, do end up, although it didn't sound like a lot of money, it does end up being enough to make a city profitable. So one day, who knows, that there may be some kind of advertising involved on the bikes or in the app. But right now we're focusing on making the cities financially viable through the revenue generated by hires and by hires alone.
Okay. So by hires and hires alone, that's really, really interesting. So you've talked about significant investment into the business, and you've talked about obviously using that investment to launch in the cities that you have launched in and are launching in, and potentially sustainability simply from the bike hire fees, the 50p fees, as you mentioned. You said, yeah, down the line, there could be advertising. Of course, you've talked about a high-profile bike scheme in London that people will be aware of, has been sponsored by a couple of high street banks and so on. But that's not necessary for your sustainability.
No.
And the other thing that some listeners might be saying is, okay, what about is there a revenue opportunity for OFU from using my data? If, you know, I'm using an app to unlock the bikes, is my data being used to be monetized? It's a fair question.
No, fair enough. So first of all, the big scheme in London, one of the reason that I always raise the issue about it not costing the council anything, taxpayers pay millions for that scheme. It's subsidized very, very heavily. It's ran very well, and like I said, it works well in the areas that it's available, and they have great vans for redistribution, and they have a lot of staff and big operations teams, etc., and that's not covered by the charges, even though they're a lot more expensive than what OFO does. It's not covered by the ride charges, so there's a huge, obviously, sponsorship deal there, which is worth millions, but then there's also a taxpayer subsidization to kind of make it all work. And that's really key. OFO doesn't charge anybody anything. It doesn't cost anybody anything. It just costs the users 50 pence per half an hour, and that's it. And we have cities all around the world that are already operationally profitable. So we know that it works, and we know that it's possible after that launch period has gone through.
Okay, grand.
Sorry, your question on...
Data.
So the data, we obviously harvest all the data. We keep all of that. We share data with the council on an anonymous level. So that is something that we do, and we're public about that to a point, in that we don't talk about names, we don't talk about contact details, we don't talk about car details. We just talk about the fact that a rider is riding a bike from here to there. And that data can, with permission, be shared, say, with universities doing social studies, and other organizations that are doing things basically that are good. So if we see that there's a benefit to somebody having this anonymous data, then we will try to encourage that data is shared from the council out. But it's to improve infrastructure, it's to improve where money needs to be spent. percent to make cycling better for everybody.
Okay, grand. That's really helpful. Thanks for that. Now, I did promise you a break, but you've been so fascinating in the studio. I have more questions for you.
That's all right. Sorry. I'm fine.
So I'm going to have to ask you some more quickfire questions, right, Adam, if right. I may, mm-hmm. before we wrap up for the end of the programme mm-hmm. today. But one of our listeners got in touch to say, what about helmets? Do you have a view on helmets? Are you encouraging people to cycle without using a helmet? Is that a bad thing? Shouldn't people be using helmets? What's your view on that?
So we definitely recommend wearing a helmet. I would never ride without a helmet myself. Not so much because I don't trust my own abilities, but if someone sideswipes you in a car and you don't know it's coming, the first thing that touches anything, apart from maybe your leg on the bumper, is your head on the windscreen. So helmets are really important, not just with contact with the ground, but with contact with other things. The problem is, and we get asked this question all the time, we do have some helmets that we use. They're branded up as OFO. Some people see them sometimes and think, oh, great, your bikes come with helmets. They're really for promotional purposes, and you know, we can use them for events and things like that. In midsummer, imagine the dock of bikes, or the three docks of bikes, the bike hubs up at the Northern General. Yep. Imagine that those bikes have all been ridden in the day for people to get from the train station in town up to the Northern General, up the hill, and they're all worn helmets, and then they're hanging those helmets off of the handlebars. The next riders that come along, when they squidge those foam padded helmets onto the head, are going to experience the dripping of somebody else's sweat running down their face. So purely from a hygiene and a comfort point of view, we're not going to be using helmets. We're not going to be supplying helmets. We do, however, recommend that you use your own helmet. Now, the kind of bikes, I have to say, are not conducive to racing around. The setup position, the pressure of the tires, the way that the gears work, etc., mean that they're very comfortable to ride, they're very easy and accessible, but you can't sort of pick up loads of speed. So if you were to ride without a helmet, particularly for short distances, you'd probably be okay. However, we would still recommend in any circumstance wearing a helmet. The cycle hub next to Shefford train station, so yep. Russell's Bicycle Shed,
indeed,
he actually stocks a type of folding helmet, and it's that kind of helmet that we really see. We've seen a surge in the cycle industry already in the design of those kind of helmets, because there were only one or two options. Now there's a few. So this is a folding helmet that you can easily carry in your bag with you all the time. It's not big and bulky. It folds down. It still meets all the European safety standards. So you unfold it out, clip it together, stick it on your head when you find a hire bike, and then off you go. You've always got a helmet with you.
Okay, so this is a way of doing a journey, many journeys by bike, quite simply and easily, and get yourself a folding helmet, which you can carry around, and then download the app and get going on an OFO.
Okay. Exactly.
Great stuff. Thanks for that, Adam. That was one question, and I hope that's answered questions that some listeners have. And in fact, I was emailed directly by a listener with that question. So secondly, Manchester saw the launch of a bike scheme, a bike sharing scheme last year. It wasn't OFO, it was a different operator. And there's been the odd but well-reported issue with that, and that may be unfair to sort of... it may be unfair to bring these up because of probably lots and lots of successful rides and uses of the scheme in Manchester. But there have been people talking about people putting the bikes in private gardens, not letting anyone else use them, and say, this is my bike now, or throwing the bikes into canals, or vandalising the bikes and so on. And I asked you earlier on about your response and how OFO will protect the bikes from being stolen. What about vandalism?
Okay, so theft is a very small problem. Vandalism is a slightly more noticeable one. Yeah. It's one that we find peters out, though. So when a city gets their hands on the bikes, the kids have their bit of fun with them, unfortunately. It's sad in a number of ways. It's kind of sad, really, that's all that they have to do and want to spend their time doing. But it does happen for a bit, and then we find it peters out. So, we deal with bikes being sort of kicked over or thrown in places where they shouldn't be thrown, and then we clean those bikes up. They get reported very quickly. Obviously, they're bright yellow. People see them when they're in places that they shouldn't be, so they get reported very quickly. Our ground team get out to them. They retrieve the bikes back and then get them back on the road almost instantly. If they can't be put back on instantly, they come back to our depot, we service them, and then they go straight back out again. Abuse is there. We know it's going to creep up, and then we know it'll peter off. Essentially, the bikes aren't going anywhere. We're not going to be deterred. If 10 bikes get wrecked, we'll put 100 more out. If 100 got wrecked, we'd put 1,000 more out. They're not going anywhere whatsoever. So it's unfortunate that it happens, but it's something we see not just in the other cities across the UK, but all the way across the world.
Okay, Super. Well, you've allayed my concerns or any worries I have. I am super excited about using OFU. Thanks so much for coming into the studio today, no problem, Adam, to talk about OFU in Sheffield. And loads in the interview there. If you've only just tuned in, you've missed a fascinating interview with Adam Rose, the operations manager of OFU, Dockless Bike Sharing, which launched in Sheffield this week. But don't panic, because you can catch up with today's programme on the podcast section of the Sheffield Live website. Just go to sheffieldlive.org, look up radio shows on the tab there, then find Business Live, and today's programme from the 12th of January 2018 will be up in the podcast section there from about 11 a.m. today, so tune in there. So download it there. Now, nearly time to wrap up. We'll be back on air next Friday. What is the Social Stock Exchange? Well, tune in next Friday to find out. It's going to be a really, really interesting show. It's been a really great show today. Thanks so much, Adam, for coming in today. Really appreciate your
time.
My
pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening. Thanks also to Sangeeta in the studio as our sound engineer with us today. But don't go away now, because next up on Sheffield Live, it's our fantastic folk music programme. Thank goodness it's folk. That's from 10 a.m. all the way through to noon. So tune in then. I've been Jamie Veitch. Get in touch. Send an email to jamie@sheffieldlive.org. Text 07904 272 200. Find me on Twitter. Find Sheffield Live on Twitter as well. Whether you're starting, running a business or a social enterprise, whether you're an entrepreneur, whether you're an employer or an employee, we're always keen to hear from you. So do get in touch. We'll play out now with a minute of a track by Portishead.
Did I see a moment with you in a half-lit world? I'm frightened to believe I must try. If I stumble, if I fall, I'm reaching out in this morning air. Have I got the strength to act?